Welcome back to Breakthrough, Waking Up to the Real You. I am your host, Alejandra Vivanco. Thank you so much for joining me today. Monday, I think this is March. Thank you so much for tuning in. Make sure to subscribe and share this podcast. Again, I am recording this way in advance. After I decided to quit my job and focus on the podcast, I really set a goal in my mind. And I remember saying, you know, I'm going to use this time as much as I can to work on the podcast in advance and read the books and do the book series, because I've always been interested in not only making myself read more. I've never been someone that liked reading, but also to learn more. And, you know, I've discussed books here that I didn't think I was going to discuss. I don't know if I've said this before, but I have a couple of books that I've read that I really liked, and I'm not making episodes on them, but I would like to recommend them. One of them is The Storyteller by Dave Grohl. He is basically the creator of the Foo Fighters and also the former drummer of Nirvana. And also another great book is Green Lights by Matthew McConaughey. If you guys are interested, it's kind of like along the lines of what we're talking about, but one of them is infused by music and the other one acting and art in general. So those are my recommendations thus far. I hope you guys like them. I am doing these books back to back to back. My goal is to do an episode a day as I, you know, record the podcast and read the books and upload the episodes and do the scheduling and all that. And it has worked really well thus far. I have taken a couple of days in between books, but there's something in me, and usually I make sure that I just go with the feeling that I have to just keep going. Like, it's an inspiration. It's like a force that I cannot explain. But it makes me feel like I want to go and do this. And I want to go read the book. And I want to do the episodes. And I want to learn more. And I want to have conversations. So far I've done since I quit my job. I quit my job mid-July. And right now, today is October 4th of 2022. That's why I was like, is it March when this is coming out? And yes, it is March when this is coming out. Because as soon as I'm recording one, I am editing, as in just putting the final touches on the episode, like basically producing it and then exporting it. And quickly I upload it to Anchor FM, which is the platform that I used for distribution. And it's been really easy. I didn't think that I was going to do as many books as I've done since July until now. And even with kind of a little bit of breaks in between books. So I am really glad that we're here right now. Obviously, I am ahead of time, but I am happy that I have the time to give these books are read. And there is something about reading a book and then, you know, in my case, obviously doing the podcast, but if you are a part of a book club or if you listen to podcasts that talk about books, it kind of helps you internalize better the information, and talking about it also helps you retain the information. That's why there's a lot of things that sometimes when I'm talking, like something that I have said before comes to mind from another book, something that I was not very good at in the beginning, or I didn't believe that I could do it. Although I have, during my acting years, I have learned very big chunks of monologues, and like we're talking about pages and pages of monologues, and sometimes until this day, I can cite some of them. That's different because you get into the character and all that, but you get what I'm saying. So today I'm going to cover, and we're going to talk about the overture and the rule number one. I wanted to do them separate, but it's such a short chapter before chapter one that I decided to just combine them. So, again, if you haven't gotten the book and you would like to read it, we're talking about 12 Rules for Life by Jordan Peterson. And, you know, every week we're doing one chapter, one rule. There's 12 of them all together. And I'm hoping that from here on out, this is going to be one rule per chapter. So if you want to get the book and give it a read, you know, give yourself the week to just read one chapter and, you know, get your notes, or if you have any questions or if you want to talk about something more, definitely I encourage you to do that. It also makes the conversation a little bit more interesting, given that the point of view of this podcast is about, you guys know, healing and a healing journey, coming into awareness and consciousness and all that good stuff we've been talking about for how many years now? This is coming 2024, so 4 years. So it's a while. There's a team, it's just me. But we, as in a community, we've been going strong with the message, because I think it's important for us to question, at the very least, what we've been taught. And if the way you've been taught life is not working for you, there's definitely an alternative. And obviously a lot of us, you know, who are in it or who have not fallen into the pits of unconsciousness, let's say, we say, yeah, obviously there's always an alternative, but it's never that easy. Because sometimes we don't think we can do it, we don't think we can make it, we don't trust ourselves, or we just don't even understand or believe there's an option for us. When we live in scarcity and we lack resources, and I'm not only talking about money, but in general, inside and out, we believe that the world is against us and we're always living with a chip on our shoulder. And I wanted to comment on something that I didn't talk about last week because there was a lot of information. But I mentioned Ben Shapiro, and I know that he has a reputation of being right wing, he says he's not right wing. He's just conservative. And I think there's a little bit of a difference there. But, you know, politics aside, he's somebody who when he talks, he not only talks really fast, but he's super book smart. He knows a lot and about a lot of things. And I remember, I think it was 2 years ago or more, when either previous to the Black Lives Matter movement or around that time, I was watching, what is the name of the YouTube? There was a YouTube channel called Abba and Preach. They are two Canadian, I believe they're Canadian-born guys who just discuss social issues and they make commentary on funny videos and all that. But I remember that they were doing some Ben Shapiro, not as in criticism, but just commentary on what he was saying. And then I've heard Ben Shapiro also talk before about people who grow up poor, that they always have a possibility of, you know, climbing the ladder socially and economically. And he never really grasped the issue of having to be in, you know, poor communities and then lack of resources and using that as an excuse to just stay in that same, you know, environment of just being poor and perpetuating, you know, poverty. And he always says the example of, I grew up in, I think he grew up in the Valley, and he had a bunch of sisters and they lived in like a 2 or 3 bedroom apartment. And, you know, both parents worked and there were a lot of sacrifices, blah, blah, blah. And to some extent, when it comes to getting out of let's say, quote unquote, the hood, or getting out of a situation where you lack resources. Obviously, there's always that possibility. And we all have the possibility of improvement. Are there going to be sacrifices? Yes, there's going to be a lot of sacrifices, because you have to basically start from zero. If you are from a one parent home where your mom has a couple of jobs to try to keep things going, and the dad is not in the picture, or none of your parents are in the picture, like Iyanla's story, right? The father was not in the picture by choice, and then the mom had passed away when she was really young, and she was living in her grandma's house, and they were poor. And obviously there was a lot of abuse and all that, but you know, it sets you up for a lot of suffering and pain and a lot of hardships. And sometimes we tend to think about success as having to constantly struggle to achieve something, which it's not necessarily true, but that's how we are wired because of our experience in growing up. So he says, you know, if you can just make a choice and change and basically choose not to, let's say, sell drugs or do illegal things to get by. But I don't think it's fair to say that, given that you have not been in that precarious situation where you have that resource only. Hence why gangs are so popular, because they fill the hole of a father in the home, or they fill a hole of basically acceptance in a group. And so at a vulnerable age, we're taught a lot of things, or not taught a lot of things. And then the choices we make coming from those spaces are questionable at the very least, but things are about survival. They're not about people wanting to do bad things or wanting to hurt people. They learn that that's how life is. So it's not that easy to be very nonchalant about certain topics and say, well, they should have, you know, they should choose differently. If you want something, you should just go and get it. True, if you really want something, you put your mind to it and you find the ways to get there. But I think we get lost in the fact that some people don't know what the steps are. And yes, you can argue and say, yeah, but they can find out 100%. But it doesn't mean that it's gonna take them even more time to get there, if they ever get there. So there's more obstacles. Does that mean that it's an excuse for people to go rob people, kill people, or sell drugs and all that on the streets? No, it's not an excuse. I would never excuse that. It's just that I feel like certain people who are in certain positions at time lack understanding of hardships that all other people go through, because the logical thing would be, yeah, of course, just get out of whatever situation you're in, choose differently, and go ahead and, you know, make money, get a couple jobs or whatever you have to do, you know, that kind of embrace suffering and embrace hardships and quote unquote man up or woman up. Again, it's not a false statement that, you know, life is about choices, but it's not that simple, because some people don't know or understand that if that's even a choice. And there can be a lot of arguments about, well, you know, some people know that there's full-time jobs or part-time jobs doing whatever. Sure, but if you're going to go to a grocery store and you're going to get X amount of money, but then you sell drugs and you get more money and you have to help, let's say, a parent, there's different circumstances. So I'm just trying to say all of this to say that there needs to be a little more understanding on how people make choices, because it's not that easy. It's very dismissive to say, you know, let's say to an abused person, say, just get out of the marriage, just get out of the relationship. Okay, if that was a choice, or that was a possibility that they had thought about before that aligned with whatever they learned when they were younger, they would have already done that, but they didn't. They don't, or they didn't. So it's always deeper than that. And in opening ourselves up to these types of conversation, it helps people who may be stuck in a cycle to say, hey, what if I made a different choice? Yes, it's going to be less than what I'm getting if I'm selling something on the streets or if I'm committing crimes. Yes, I'm going to be ostracized by the group or wherever you come from and what the standards are. But the goal, the aim is to get out of this place in a way that I don't have to break the law or I don't have to have a record, or I can believe in myself that I can get better if I just wait for that gratification, that it's not going to be this year, but it may be 2-3 years. Hence why a lot of people that do things that are like this, for example, either podcasts or videos, or they create channels, where whatever platform you're using, you have to believe in yourself enough to know that whatever you're putting out is good enough. You're doing 100% the work. That doesn't mean you burn out. It just means that you show up 100%. And if you don't get that feedback, then you keep going if you really believe that's what you're going to do. So eventually you'll get to a point where you get to decide, I'm going to continue because I've been in this, let's say, 5 years, or I'm going to stop because something else has opened up. So it's always about being consistent and disciplined without just seeking something quick, like either attention or followers or likes or shares, or in case of people, you know, trying to survive, getting quick money, a lot of money, or, you know, showing up, you know, on Instagram and showing off and, you know, getting that type of attention. So the human brain and our experiences and traumas and the things that we don't see, the truths that we don't tell, and our belief systems are different than other people. And that's why it said in the book in the beginning, you know, it's not that easy to look at others and just judge them, but there's no understanding. We cannot simplify people or reduce people to our own ideas because we don't understand where they're coming from and what exactly is working on their brains or anything that comes from their home, how that's working for them or against them. So these are very complex issues that I think that we tend to simplify by just telling people what to do. And I don't think comparing anybody's experience to other people's experiences is doing any good, just because we don't know how this individual reacts to this environment and this individual reacts to maybe the same environment, but he or she might be hypersensitive, or they have a history of depression in their family. Like, we don't know. We just don't know. Now, it doesn't mean that I am for or against what Ben Shapiro symbolizes, because I do like listening to him. I even had audiobooks, one of his books that a friend gave to me. And I really do like the way he speaks and he communicates as Jordan Peterson. But I think that sometimes, because we're so in the mix of, so this is the right thing to do, and this is what you should do, and this is what you shouldn't do, and no excuses, which is true. To some extent, it's true. But it's just very dismissive of people's experiences. On the other side, people who may come across these messages, don't get discouraged, because, yes, you shouldn't have to rely on excuses to not better yourself in life, as in create a better environment for yourself, a safe environment and a stable environment. It's going to be harder, and we have to accept that. Does that make sense? I hope it did. Anyway, that's something that I forgot to mention. last week, and I thought that it was important. And as soon as I sat down, the first image that came to my mind was Ben Shapiro in that video where he says that, you know, yeah, you were poor. And so it's true. I mean, I'm not refuting what he's saying. I'm just saying that it's, even though he's right, it's far more complex than how he communicates it. And I don't think he obviously has the time of energy to, you know, give those types of speeches unless he does them when he goes to universities. But I've never heard him have an understanding or compassionate take on things, because obviously he is, if you look at, I think it's his Twitter that says facts over feelings. And I agree 100%, but we also need that other side of the narrative. And that's why I wanted to mention that. So anyway, so I got some great passages from the book. Here it says, I had read more than my share of dark books about the 20th century. Okay, so first of all, Jordan Peterson is obsessed with the 20th century because of what happened. So he says, focusing particularly on Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the great documenter of the slave labor camp horrors of the latter, once wrote that the pitiful ideology holding that human beings are created for happiness. So it says here, in a crisis, the inevitable suffering that life entails can rapidly make a mockery of the idea that happiness is the proper pursuit of the individual. On the radio show, I suggested instead that a deeper meaning was required. I noted that the nature of such meaning was constantly represented in the great stories of the past, and that it had more to do with developing character in the face of suffering than with happiness. So, kind of like what Eckhart Tolle says, which is, you know, if, first of all, happiness is not out there. And then we would have to discuss what happiness really is. So we don't know what happiness is. And we cannot look for something that we don't know what exactly it is. Sometimes we say happiness would be having a family and a car and a couple kids and a job. We believe that's what happiness is. And I think that even though on paper it looks good, nothing outside of yourself can give you that and sustain that forever. Because the people that I've talked to, when I ask happiness or success, which come together in the package, basically, they are intertwined. They say, well, having a career. And I've recently spoken to someone that when we started talking, I said, "What? How do you define success?" And she said, you know, having a job that I like. And now she has two jobs and she's going again to two jobs that she studied for. It's not like she has like part-time jobs in, you know, I don't know, like at a grocery store where she didn't put her knowledge to, you know, she didn't go to school for that. She went to school, she became one thing, and now she's going to school to become another thing. And they gave her the opportunity to begin working. And, you know, she's a busy Bieber. And then, you know, again, what is success? And she said the same thing. And I'm like, well, you have two jobs and you're going to college. How are you not already successful if that's what you're really looking for? When we broke it down, obviously she wasn't looking for success. She was looking for something else. But the point is that we cannot be in the pursuit of happiness because we don't know what that is. And if you cannot be happy today, why would you think that something tomorrow outside of your control and outside of yourself can give you that happiness and maintain that until you die? And how do we know that that happiness that somebody, let's say when you start a relationship, everything is fun and games and all the flirting and stuff like that, gives you like a high. But then how do you know that when you are, you know, after 10 years of marriage, that's going to still keep going? It can't. It can evolve. I believe that you can transform or the relationship can grow in a different way. But to think that somebody else out there needs to be responsible for your own happiness, I think that's unfair for anybody. You cannot give somebody a responsibility that they didn't ask for, like I always say, and also that we don't know they're capable of. And even if they were capable of, how do we know they know exactly how to do it and to maintain that? So That's why he says it had to do more with developing character in the face of suffering than with happiness, which is why he has studied how storytelling has evolved over time. But the same thing happens. The hero's journey or the hero's quest is to go outside of your comfort zone, face the unknown, and then you develop character and you come back home. Which I basically apply to what we have been doing thus far, you know, coming up outside of your comfort zone, as in facing your fears and facing yourself so that you can come back home, as in to your true self. So he says, for the Taoists, meaning is to be found on the border between the ever entwined pair. To walk that border is to stay on the path of life, the divine way. So he says that order and chaos are the yang and the yin of the that are represented in the symbol. So the two serpents head to tail. So the order is the white masculine serpent and chaos its black feminine counterpart. The black dot in the white and the white in the black indicate the possibility of transformation. Just when things seem secure, the unknown can loom unexpectedly and large. Conversely, just when everything seems lost, new order can emerge from catastrophe and chaos. So this is something that I've made reference to before, which is I learned from Jordan Peterson that chaos is feminine and order is masculine. And he talks about it in the book. So you guys go get the book and then you can read more about that. But basically, if there's only order all the time, then there's never going to be any change. So you need a little bit of chaos. But if there's chaos all the time, then there's never a structure, and we need a structure. Even though we want to be, you know, all hippity dippity, you know, we need some sort of order to organize our lives. And the only way to do that is to find, my cat is crying, is to find a way for us to organize our brains. And we get, by reading, let's say, this book, we have the possibility to release some agreements and create new ones so that we're able to live a more meaningful life without the fears of the past, without the programming of the past, and bring in a little bit of chaos without being fear-based, and help that can help us challenge ourselves and evolve. Okay, so let's continue. So he says, people who live by the same code are rendered mutually predictable to one another. They act in keeping with each other's expectations and desires. They can cooperate. They can even compete peacefully because everyone knows what to expect from everyone else. A shared belief system, partly psychological, partly acted out, simplifies everyone in their own eyes and in the eyes of others. Shared beliefs simplify the world as well because people who know what to expect from one another can act together to tame the world. There is perhaps nothing more important than the maintenance of this organization, the simplification, if it's threatened, the great ship of state rocks. So basically he says that what unites us is that we have a cultural system that we share, obviously where you're from, with the people that are around you, and there is a hierarchy of value, and we give, some things are giving a priority and importance and others are not. And that's one of the things that why he was so interested in, you know, let's say the Cold War, because he said that he couldn't understand that how belief systems could be so important to people that they were willing to risk the destruction of the world to protect them. But so he says, action and perception require a goal, and a valid goal is by necessity something valued. We experience much of our positive emotion in relation to goals. Oh, don't we know it? We're not happy, technically speaking, unless we see ourselves progressing, and the very idea of progression implies value. Worse yet is the fact that the meaning of life without positive value is not simply neutral. That's a very interesting point, because we are vulnerable and mortal. Pain and anxiety are an integral part of human existence. We must have the meaning inherent in a profound system of value, or the horror of existence rapidly becomes paramount. Then nihilism beckons with its hopelessness and despair. So think about your home. You know, there's a shared value. There's a shared system of beliefs. And that we are working all for the same goal. So, you know, you go out into the world and you basically mimic what you learned at home. And that's what you learned at home, what your parents taught you, whether by teaching you or showing you in their actions or behaviors, they learned from their grandparents and so on and so forth and so on and so forth. So there is always a goal in mind. And it's very interesting that he says, you know, the meaning of life without positive value is not simply neutral because of how we're wired. So we need some sort of, again, purpose to keep going. And I think that's why it's very easy for us to identify with a career, because it gives us purpose. Remember, when you are very young, what do you like to do? What would you like to be? And then you go based on those ideas, you live your life in school, and then you learn a lot about the same things. You can even do things outside of school that are kind of helping you develop whatever you like. And then you go to college, and then that's the line. That's the only line I think that we, as, let's say, I'm going to talk about my generation only, or let me just talk about myself and my experience. But that's the line I have seen that matters the most, because that's a specific goal. I'm going to become an actress. Okay, so everything that I'm going to do from that statement has to support the fact that I have to be an actress. So that gives us some sort of purpose and meaning. The gag is that once you become it, then it's like, okay, this is it. But there's also the belief system and the values that some people do not question, and they keep going. You know, I have to have a family. So there is this picture perfect idea of what we're supposed to do. And if you go to the other side and you say, this doesn't mean anything to me, you know, that's why he says nihilism beckons with his hopelessness and despair, because it means that you believe that none of that is giving you any type of satisfaction and nothing has any meaning. Therefore, what's the point? Does that make sense? So, and when he talks about, you know, when the ship is threatened, when we're threatened with our values, obviously that's what makes us closer. We're always looking for a common enemy to fight against, you know, whether that's in sports or fighting other countries or finding, let's say, a neighbor that we all don't like. There's always that common threat that once we see it, we unite against it because it threatens what we know. So it's from our belief systems and our values, we kind of know how to navigate life. When those are threatened, they threaten our stability and security. Therefore, we kind of need to fight back. So then he says he had a dream, and he sees like a cross in a cathedral, and he says that the cross represented that there's a point in the cross that represents great suffering, point of death and transformation, and the symbolic center of the world. He says existence at that cross is suffering and transformation, and that fact above all needs to be voluntarily accepted. It is possible to transcend slavish adherence to the group and its doctrines, and simultaneously to avoid the pitfalls of its opposite extreme, nihilism. It is possible instead to find sufficient meaning in individual consciousness and experience. Through the elevation and development of the individual, and through the willingness of everyone to shoulder the burden of being and to take the heroic path, we must each adopt as much responsibility as possible for individual life, society, and the world. And so he says that in order for us to change, we need to be in that point of, and again, I'm talking strictly from the book, that when you suffer the most and you shoulder that burden, you find yourself, something in you dying, and you transform yourself into an evolved version of yourself. You kind of like grow up, basically. And so the more responsibility you take, the more you give yourself a chance to evolve. And it's the heroic thing is in the willingness to shoulder that burden instead of run away from the responsibility that we must all face, which we do. That's just how it is. Okay, so I think that one of the questions that I just take from the last statement is, what is the impact our lives growing up that is so hard or so heavy that we're not willing to burden more responsibility? Because again, remember, if you grow up in an environment where you are basically on survival mode and emotionally you haven't grown up, when you go out into the world and you have kind of made an agreement that you're going to take responsibility at the very least for, you know, your career and any resources you might have, having to shoulder more, like he says, we're not willing or we don't believe we're capable of doing more because we're already bringing in a burden, emotional burden from the past. Now, we've talked about this plenty, so I hope that you are able to take in the information without being like, oh, you know, like kind of those people that say you are too sensitive or you should just shake it off or you need to just keep it pushing. Yeah, sure, that there's no other choice but to keep going. But I do believe that one of the reasons why there's so many people that feel stuck and they don't want to do more for themselves is because there's already something in them that feels like it's too much and they don't want to keep going, shouldering more responsibility because they're already dealing with something that happened to them that they didn't ask for, but they have to deal with either way. So then he says that the sweet spot, like the yin and the yang thing, is to be in the middle of the order and chaos. So we require rules, standards, values, alone and together. We're pack animals, beasts of burden. We must bear a load to justify our miserable existence. We require routine and tradition. That's order. Order can become excessive, and that's not good. But chaos can swamp us, and so we drown, and it is also not good. So when you find yourself, and I think that's kind of the point of view, when you find yourself hopeless and you believe that, you know, nothing matters or there's no value to doing something, you know, he kind of gives you a little push and says, get out of there, get out of your comfort zone. And even if you're suffering, go ahead and take some responsibility and eventually you're going to develop character. That's what he says. And he is obviously a clinical psychologist and a professor of psychology. So I don't think like he's just saying that just because. But what I'm saying is that that's kind of the energy where he's coming from. Because by doing mechanically certain things, we can begin to find or reshape how we see life. Now, that is true. But at the same time, I do believe that we need to always address what we've been talking about for the longest time, right? So take everything with a little bit of space, question things. Do not just say, oh, my life is miserable, and that's what he's saying. It's about us finding purpose in the midst of chaos and not ruling out, you know, some order that we have been given. Again, if I hadn't been given that sense of having to do things and be responsible and be consistent and make something out of anything and do something for myself, then I don't think I would be here sitting down with you. But with that, that's what I have taken from my experiences as a young woman. With that came a lot of extra shit that I didn't need. and that I had to deal with as well. So it's about you gathering all the information, resources, and then you get to choose what you're going to use or apply today so that you can better yourself tomorrow. As in evolve, transform, whatever better means for you. It doesn't mean that you acquire more money, because I don't think that accumulating wealth is necessarily something that it's good for your spirit. But definitely, I think that it's a marker that says, hey, you're doing something good and you're getting rewarded. If you're doing it by legal means, I mean. Anyway, so we have here rule number one, stand up straight with your shoulders back, which is something that I didn't do for a long time until I went to my scamming chiropractor and I finally got my posture, you know, my muscles to all align and adjust accordingly. But it's important for us to do that. And just a little bit of a story on that. I've always had bad posture. I remember I'm telling the story, but I'm going to tell it again. My grandma used to punch me in the back. And it would be like a really, like she was a heavy puncher. And so it would really hurt. And her message was to stand up straight because she had great posture. But I just couldn't get into it because, as we find out in the first chapter, is that doing the, our posture says a lot about how we feel and what we think of ourselves. So what's really happening in our brains. So I couldn't stand up straight because, you know, I had been shamed so much over the fact that I was obese or fat, overweight, that I had to hide my tummy. And in order for me to do that was to suck in my ass, you know, like tilt my pelvis forward, which years later, as I said, I really had to address that issue because that's not the right posture. But also I had to hunch over a little bit so that you couldn't see my tummy. And what I created was basically I had overdeveloped my back. You know, my upper back was longer because it had been extended for the longest because I was hunching forward. And the muscles that are in the pecs were short because I had been hunching forward. So it was very tough for me to get my posture because it created a lot of pain for me. And I couldn't understand, obviously, when you have been in such a bad posture for so many years, obviously you don't understand that that's wrong unless you see yourself in video. That's going to change your mind really quickly. So it took a while for me, but I remember that I had discovered that somewhere along the way, I had gotten my posture to one shoulder. My cat is here. Hold on 1 second. Okay, my cat got on top of the desk and she was just playing with the selenite wands. Anyway, so in that time, because it was mid-30s where I got, you know, when I fixed my posture, but somewhere along the way, I had fixed one side of my body. So my left shoulder would be straight, you know, your shoulders are supposed to drape over your body so that you're just naturally, everything is being pulled down nice and easy. There's no effort from your part. But my right shoulder was hunching forward. So when I was doing, you know, lifting weights or doing any type of exercises, I was always in pain on my right side because my shoulder was forward. So for the longest time when I would, let's say, see myself in video, I would feel really uncomfortable because I was obviously aware of how I looked, but furthermore, the way that I looked, it was like timid, if that makes sense. That was my perception of myself. And so for it to say, stand up straight with your shoulders back, and we're going to get into that, I think it's very important because that's how you are going to represent yourself and show yourself in the world. So in the beginning, he talks about lobsters and territory, birds and territory, and how lobsters have been here way before dinosaurs, and how their nervous system has evolved, and how hierarchies work in lobsters. But basically, the biggest or the strongest male that wins the fights and wins the girls is the one who stands up, and the ones that are defeated, their brains basically disintegrate and they create a new kind of like a beta brain. You know, they know they are lower on the totem pole. So let's see here. It says here, first, it's easy to assume that quote-unquote nature is something with a nature, something static, but it's not, at least not in any simple sense. It's static and dynamic at the same time. The environment, the nature that it selects itself transforms. The famous yin and yang symbols of the Taoists captured this beautifully. Is composed of two opposing principles, as we talked about, often translated as feminine and masculine, or even more narrowly as female and male. However, yin and yang are more accurately understood as chaos and order, and is a circle enclosing twin serpents, head to tail. The black serpent, chaos, has a white dot in its head, and the white serpent, order, has a black dot in its head. This is because chaos and order are interchangeable, as well as eternally juxtaposed. There is nothing so certain that it cannot vary. Even the sun itself has its cycles of instability. Likewise, there is nothing so mutable that it cannot be fixed. Every revolution produces a new order. Every death is simultaneously a metamorphosis, which is something that we've talked about, but we have applied death and the idea that something has to die for something to be born to ideas and also to the ego, because the ego never wants to die because it doesn't want to see you transform into your true self. And also he talks about how order, there's an order in things, like a higher order. And it has been in nature for eons because, you know, the things that work stay and the things that have to change kind of begin changing, like the weather or, you know, the leaves fall, but the tree stays and all that. Again, get the book. So it's constantly an evolution of things, but there are some things that remain the same, if that makes sense. And I love this quote. It says from the Alice in Wonderland, the Red Queen tells Alice, "In my kingdom, you have to run as fast as you can just to stay in the same place. No one standing still can triumph, no matter how well constituted." It's chaos within order, within chaos, within higher order. The order that is most real is the order that is most unchanging. And that is not necessarily the order that is most easily seen. The leaf, when perceived, might blind the observer to the tree. The tree can blind him to the forest. And some things that are most real, such as the ever-present dominance hierarchy, cannot be seen at all. I love that. No one standing still can triumph, no matter how. So it means that you have to keep on going to keep the status. That's what the Red Queen is telling Alice in Wonderland. So nature is what selects, and the longer a feature has existed, like I said before, the more time it has had to be selected and to shape life. When we are defeated, and this is where we're getting to why the posture is so important. When we are defeated, we act very much like lobsters who have lost a fight. Our posture droops. We face the ground. We feel threatened, hurt, anxious, and weak. Low serotonin means less happiness, more pain and anxiety, more illness, and a short lifespan. So, you know, body language, right? When people don't look up, when people get uncomfortable, when people try to hide themselves, and this is what I used to do, that's why this sounds so familiar. You know, you try to hide yourself in the corner, or you look down, or you never want to open yourself up to the world. And if you see videos of people talking about body language, you know, one of the most common ones is when people have good posture and they're open, you know, their chest is exposed and they seem confident. You know, their eyes are looking not up or down, but straight forward. And when they're talking to you, they are not hiding, you know, crossing their arms or crossing their legs. Like, it's very, it's kind of like they believe in themselves. That's the vibe they give. So if you see somebody that is hunched over and they are like kind of looking down, energy is low, and they seem a little bit lost or out of it, or they are closed off, that means that they are insecure and body language wise, and they are not open to the experience, basically. And he says that when lobsters win, that's why he talks about serotonin, they release more serotonin in their system. Okay, so here it says, the ancient part of your brain specialized for assessing dominance watches how you're treated by other people. On that evidence, it renders a determination of your value and assigns you a status. If you are judged by your peers as a little worth, the counter restricts serotonin availability. That makes you much more physically and psychologically reactive to any circumstance or event that might produce emotion, particularly if it's negative. You need that reactivity. Emergencies are coming at the bottom, and you must be ready to survive. This is survival mode. Okay? Unfortunately, that physical hyper-response, that constant alertness, burns up a lot of precious energy and physical resources. This response is really what everyone calls stress. And it is by no means only or even primarily psychological. It's a reflection of the genuine constraints of unfortunate circumstances. When operating at the bottom, the ancient brain counter-assumes that even the smallest unexpected impediment might produce an uncontrollable chain of negative events, which will have to be handled alone, as useful friends are rare indeed on society's fringes. You will therefore continually sacrifice what you could otherwise physically store for the future, using it up on heightened readiness and the possibility of immediate panicked action in the present. When you don't know what to do, you must be prepared to do anything and everything in case it becomes necessary. Again, survival mode. You are sitting in your car with the gas and brake pedals both punched to the mat. Too much of that and everything falls apart. The ancient counter will even shut down your immune system, expending the energy and resources required for future health now during the crisis of the present. It will render you impulsive so that you will jump, for example, at any short-term mating opportunities or any possibilities of pleasure, no matter how subpar, disgraceful, or illegal. It will leave you far more likely to live or die carelessly for a rare opportunity at pleasure when it manifests itself. The physical demands of emergency preparedness will wear you down in every way. And I think that what I just read kind of explains what I was talking about, what Ben Shapiro said about people, you know, if you're poor, you get a choice to, you know, not be poor and work and do all this and that. True. Yet, when we think about how the brain begins to form in an environment where it's all about survival, it's very hard for people to really think straight and clearly when they're always thinking about the threat or danger coming their way. So you're not wired to think, you know, oh, life is full of possibilities, you know, let me get it cracking here. No, it's about death is imminent any minute, or the threat is coming for me and I need to survive. And when we are up against a wall, or we feel like we're up against a wall constantly, we will do anything for something immediate instead of thinking long term, because we don't have that luxury. You understand what I'm saying? For example, it says here, it will render you impulsive so that you will jump, for example, at any short-term mating opportunities or any possibilities of pleasure, no matter how subpar, disgraceful, or illegal. So again, we're not thinking clearly, obviously, because we're just looking at, if you really think about people who have come, and it doesn't matter how wealthy they are now or how much money they have or what type of material stability they display or luxury. If they haven't addressed their issues from the past accordingly, they will perpetuate the same patterns as they are in different positions, you know? And they won't choose somebody that it's worthy of them because there's already something in them that says, you know, I just need to jump to the opportunity of an idea of something better than. And so that's how we create dysfunctional families and we perpetuate cycles. And it's about living or dying. It's not about growth and evolution and finding yourself and being spiritually awakened or balanced. It has nothing to do with that. That's why I know that if a message comes to you from any of the books or all the stories that I've been talking about, and it resonates with you somehow, I do believe that you're open the door to a possibility you didn't think there existed. And I understand survival mode, and I have an episode called Survival Mode. And we're not thinking about anything but survive. Like, our intentions, our whole energy is about, I have to survive. Because the threat is imminent. And that's why when I talk about, you know, I don't like going out, or I don't like doing anything but being at home, it's because for so many years, every time that I can think of, you know, when I used to live in my country, the only thing that I wanted was to leave my house because I didn't feel safe. And obviously, I found groups of people that were not safe either, but they were safer than my own home because I had lived under that threat for so long. So I chose people. And again, those choices are questionable in hindsight because in my head, they were good choices. But again, we don't know what good or bad is. But now, thinking about it, obviously there were not good choices that I had, you know, available to me or that I was willing to see. And that's why I exposed myself to that first violent relationship. And then again, to violent encounters in relationships because of how I perceived danger and how I was used to abuse, but also because I knew that anything outside my house had to be better, 100%, which wasn't, obviously. So here he says, we go to the other side. So it says, if you have a high status, on the other hand, the counter's cold. Pre-reptilian mechanics assume that your niche is secure, productive, and safe, and that you are well buttressed with social support. It thinks the chance that something will damage you is low and can be safely discounted. Change might be opportunity instead of disaster. The serotonin flows plentifully. This renders you confident and calm, standing tall and straight, and much less on constant alert because your position is secure. The future is likely to be good for you. It's worthwhile to think in the long term and plan for a better tomorrow. You don't need to grasp impulsively at whatever crumbs come your way because you can realistically expect good things to remain available. You can delay gratification without foregoing it forever. You can afford to be a reliable and thoughtful citizen. Right? Am I right or am I right? So that gives us a little bit of an insight of how we may think or perceive the world and perceive opportunities and, you know, what informs our choices every day and how we're living, even though we may be, you know, if you're one of the quote unquote lucky ones that, you know, accumulated a little bit of wealth and have a little bit of material stability, you may want to think about what you have chosen thus far and what is motivating every single thing you do in regards to the choices you make, you know, relationships or jobs or any opportunity that comes your way, so that you can assess what's really an opportunity and what's really just something that you feel like if you don't take it now, it's just, you're just going to be, you know, poor again, you know, that type of thing. And then there's a bunch of stories that I encourage you to read, but one of them is about bullying. And here it says that people that have been bullied before, and he describes how they are. So it also happens to people who have decided for one reason or another that all forms of aggression, including even feelings of anger, are morally wrong. I've seen people with particularly acute sensitivity to petty, to aggressive competitiveness, or often they are people whose fathers were excessively angry and controlling. Psychological forces are never unidimensional in their value, however, and the truly appalling potential of anger and aggression to produce cruelty and mayhem is balanced by the ability of those primordial forces to push back against oppression, speak the truth, and motivate resolute movement forward in times of strife, uncertainty, and danger. So people who have an opinion about expressing anger. And, you know, this is one of the things that I've found in some people that I've spoken to, that when it comes to really, validating their feelings, they do not allow themselves to express anger. And that's something that Dr. Eager talks about in The Choice, because they believe that it's either wrong, like they have given anger a value, and they wouldn't be a good person if they were to express anger, because why? Anger is not something that's good. And they have learned that because, and what it says here in the book, we're talking about Jordan Peterson's book, is that if they have encountered, let's say, a father who's aggressive, they have obviously placed them in the category of bad. So anger is bad, therefore I shouldn't get angry. But it's about us, like I've said before, he says that you have to get to know that side of you so you know how to control it, how to tame the lion or the monster, so that you know you can go there and it doesn't control you if you are up against a wall. And people who don't say, here it says, if you say no early in the cycle of oppression and you mean what you say, which means you state your refusal in no uncertain terms and stand behind it, then the scope for oppression on the part of the oppressor will remain properly bounded and limited. People who refuse to muster appropriately self-protective territorial responses are laid open to exploitation as much as those who genuinely can't stand up for their own rights because of a more essential inability or a true imbalance in power, so boundaries, basically. And that is something that I have learned and talked about before. My no's, which are valid, you can always say no. It's you and you that are putting yourself, blocking yourself from stating the truth. But I was not able to say no because I didn't even know that was a possibility at the time. And I would let people push me so far that when I would say no, it would come out conflictive. There was always anger. There was always rage. So it was never well received because I was not able to communicate in a healthy way my boundaries. And I didn't want to do what people wanted me to do, but then sometimes I would have to do it. I would just have to comply. And so little by little, I was building up that resentment and anger that I didn't know I could express. And that's why people who know me from the past, you know, my past self, as I can describe, would say that I was a very angry person because my whole energy shifted. Remember, I was hunched over, I was looking down, and I was always with a resting bitch face because I had learned that that's how I could protect myself constantly. I didn't want people to come close to me, even though I wanted to have interactions with people, but I already knew what happened when people came close to me. So I would rather, you know, choose not to be around people, and my energy gave that out. So if you don't set boundaries, I don't care how old you are and how old your parents are, but there are things that are, if you feel uncomfortable with certain things, comments, then you have the right, if not, you have the duty to state your truth and say no. And it doesn't matter who gets upset, let them get upset. But what I have noticed is that in relationships, they are very transactional, meaning that I give you something, you give me something, and we play this role, these roles, and we play this game. If you don't play the game, then I am going to be mad at you. Therefore, you're not allowed to say no, so I can do whatever I want to do, and you do your part. So it's very, very important for us to not let ourselves get to a point where we are so resentful and angry at other people that then our no comes out in a way that we know people are going to point the finger at us and say, oh, see, I told you guys, she was this, she was that. Instead, we should just make those necessary stops in between so that people don't do whatever they want in our lives. So it says, naive beliefs can become a positive invitation to abuse because those who aim to harm have become specialized to prey on people who think precisely such things. Under such conditions, the axioms of harmlessness must be retooled. In my clinical practice, I often draw the attention of my clients who think that good people never become angry to the stark realities of their own resentments. And again, somebody needs somebody else to play the game in order for those power positions to be to emerge. A bully needs to find somebody that they feel like they can bully. And in families, unfortunately, those who have power are caretakers. And if they don't have a way out, because remember, my mom couldn't stand up to my dad, but she could do whatever she wanted with us. So we would get beaten constantly and psychologically abused and emotionally abused because she couldn't face her own bully. But we had to, you know, and then we couldn't do anything because we didn't go to school and we were not bullies. I would get into arguments, but I was never that like that. But then it all came around when I was older and my brother was older, and then we would fight back. So she didn't have any choice but to stop. Or if she wanted to start something, she knew that we were going to pull up and we were going to show up and we were going to defend ourselves because enough was enough. So to stand your ground and be secure of yourself is to begin by accepting that anger is normal. It's something that happens to all of us. You are allowed to be angry about things that happen to you. We don't talk about that enough. But furthermore, the way you can begin to, I want to use the word manifest that, but I mean it as the way you can initiate that process is to stand straight with your shoulders back and face the world and face the unknown. And do not, and I think that there is an emotional component to it, as in we haven't grown up enough. And so we don't want to shoulder the burdens of the world because we're still emotionally a kid. And so when things get tough, and I've talked about this plenty in my life with my examples, we cower back and we don't know what to do. And we become like a little ball. And we don't know where to look or what to do. We look to the ground and we become small. And I think that stand straight with your shoulders back is about you opening yourself up to the challenges fearlessly. Even with fear, you can be fearless because you know that you're able and willing and capable to face a challenge and get through it. And that's how you transform. Because something in you died, maybe a fear. And then you now know that you're capable of facing that challenge or challenges that look the same or feel the same. So it says here, when the awakening occurs, when once naive people recognize in themselves the seeds of evil and monstrosity and see themselves as dangerous, at least potentially, their fears decreases. They develop more self-respect, then perhaps they begin to resist oppression. They see that they have the ability to withstand because they are terrible too. They see they can and must stand up because they begin to understand how genuinely monstrous they will become, otherwise feeding on their resentment, transforming it into the most destructive of wishes. To say it again, there is very little difference between the capacity for mayhem and destruction integrated and strength of character. This is one of the most difficult lessons in life. So if you know you are capable of being that monstrous, and I don't know if you guys heard the episode that I did regarding me quitting my job. I don't know if it was the Audacity or the Audacity part two, but I remember listening to Jordan Peterson talk about how you know how capable you are of being a monster. And it's about choosing to not go there and take the necessary steps to avoid going there that is going to make you I don't know if better human being is a word, but let's choose it for now. And so when I was working at the veterinarian practice, I had a choice to make. I felt like I was at a crossroads, and that was the day that I decided to quit. When this doctor, she kept poking, and there was a buildup already, and I had asked for some sort of help to manage some resources, to manage her bad behavior, basically, and her negativity, her constant negativity. And she was a bully. She's still a bully. And I was never helped with that because she's who she is and things are the way they are. But I had negotiated with myself that I wanted to stay. And so I kept staying in that place because I really wanted to work. I really like the people, but she was a problem, and it was not a problem with me. It was just a problem in general in the practice that people had, they had quit before because of her. People when I was the same position I had been in, a lot of people had quit because they couldn't stand her. They would say, oh, I'm quitting because of this, or I'm leaving. They wouldn't show up. But she was always a constant factor in people quitting. So I remember that I know how slick my mouth can get. I know how to be venomous. And I learned that when I was growing up. And you should know that too. How far you can go with your words or actions. You should know where things can take you when everything is up against you, or you feel like you're threatened, or you feel like there's a danger involved. And it's very easy, and I know low vibrational, as in you engage in something that you know is going to perpetuate pain. And even though you are, you know, somebody's trying to make you feel some sort of way or assess themselves as in they're higher than you in the hierarchy ranks or whatever, they'll do anything because they're very insecure. And again, I had been told 1,000 times she doesn't mean it that way, but it's like it was like venom constantly coming out of her mouth, not only about things in the practice, but people that would come with sick pets to the practice. So it was just really, it was really a bad experience overall. But the point is that before, like 20 minutes before I quit, I remember going to one of the doctors and asking them a question, and I had already put something on a schedule, and then She was trying to be slick and kind of be snappy at me because I didn't do something she wanted me to do, or I didn't color code the fucking schedule that when she wanted me to do, like an appointment. Which again, these are like minute things, like they didn't matter in the grand scheme of things. It was a busy practice. The dog was sick. You know, the point is that she said something to me, and for a quarter of a second, I had a choice to make, and I knew enough about her and the things that had happened to her and the things that she felt bad about that I knew that I could say something to shut it down. I knew it, and the reward was immediate because I knew that she was going to cry, and I knew that she was going to be like a she was going to attack like a hurt dog, and then she was going to go cry in the bathroom, and then she was going to blame the whole day being off to me. So she was going to blame me because of what I said, and she was going to go complain and all that. And of course, nothing was going to happen to me because everybody kind of understood who she was. And, you know, if somebody snaps back, you know, be ready to just take it. And then obviously there was going to be a conversation and all that. And, you know, you have to deal with, again, having to deal with the aftermath of what you said that you knew, because that's calculated, obviously. But I went into that. Like, I opened the door to all the information I had that I had recollected for months, not something that I did because I was planning on doing something, but it's just that I have a good memory and I know what you did and I know things that you have done and I know things that you regret and I know your family life and I know what really hurts you. So I could easily go open the door, get one thing out and then just throw it, just throw the dart. But I didn't. And because I knew how close I was to reacting to that, I decided that it was better for me to quit because I knew that I would get pushed so far because it's not something that I could resolve right away. I knew that it was going to be there. It was going to bug me. It was going to bother me. And I would eventually we would have to fight. You know, just argue. And I knew that she didn't have enough points to win the argument. I knew that because I knew more about her because she liked to talk too much that she knew about me. So I knew that I could use her story basically against her and every single thing she has done. But I didn't want to go out that way. So the point is that I stood up for myself, not in a way that was, again, low vibrational and I'm going to make a problem and we're going to fight and argue and I'm going to sting you. I'm standing up for myself by removing myself from a situation. Yes, is it optimal because I don't have an income? No, obviously it's not. But again, I redirected my goals and changed a little bit my perspective and said, let me just focus on the podcast. I know that there's enough money. I'm okay. And if I ever need to reinsert myself back in, you know, doing part-time or full-time jobs, I will gladly do it. I take full responsibility for everything. And that's something that you have to do and be capable of doing. Because then what happens is that if you don't really explore how dark you can go or how low you can go, when you do it, when it actually comes out, when the monster comes out, you're going to, you know, throw your hands in the air and say, well, you know, you made me do it, or it wasn't my fault, or you know how you push so much and then blah, 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 instead of creating those boundaries to protect yourself and to keep the monster at bay. Does that make sense? Okay. So he says that if you are assigned a lower status, your brain will not produce enough serotonin. And that means that you're going to be less happy and more anxious and sad and more likely to back down when you should stand up for yourself. It would also decrease the probability that you will get to live in a good neighborhood, have access to the highest quality resources, and obtain a healthy, desirable mate. It will render you more likely to abuse drugs as you live for the present in a world full of uncertain futures. And I remember that when I was around 14 or 15, I was told by this really bad kid psychologist that she just, after a couple of visits, she just wanted to medicate me because she didn't want me to be depressed. I don't know if it was a medication that makes my brain produce serotonin or endorphins. I don't really remember, but I remember that I don't know where I have heard that if you work out, that kind of produces the same thing. So I decided to not only stop seeing her. So I told my dad, obviously my dad was ashamed. So I told him, hey, I'm not going to go again and I'm going to do me. And that's when I started to really get into exercising and it made things a little bit more bearable. So it says, standing up physically also implies and invokes and demands standing up metaphysically. Standing up means voluntarily accepting the burden of being. Your nervous system responds in an entirely different manner when you face the demands of life voluntarily. You respond to a challenge instead of bracing for a catastrophe. You see the gold the dragon hoards instead of shrinking in terror from the all-too-real fact of the dragon. You step forward to take your place in the dominance hierarchy and occupy your territory, manifesting your willingness to defend, expand, and transform it. And that it means adopting the burden of self-conscious vulnerability and accepting the end of the unconscious paradise of childhood, where mortality are only dimly comprehended. It means willingly undertaking the sacrifices necessary to generate a productive and meaningful reality. So attend carefully to your posture, quit drooping and hunching around. Speak your mind, put your desires forward as if you had a right to them. Then you may be able to accept the terrible burden of the world and find joy. That's the first rule. And I think that when you begin to train yourself to speak your truth, regardless of the outcome, when you begin to create boundaries regardless of outcome, when you really begin to trust and believe that what you say matters, and that you begin to create space within yourself and in other spaces to be, it changes how you live your life, 110%. Because when you are in an argument and you haven't spoken your truth since ever, you have never said no, and you're speaking to someone that is really trying to push your buttons without maybe knowing that they're trying to push them, but either way, that's the result, the consequence. You're really going to find your first no and your truth to be overshadowed by all the no's and all the times you couldn't speak your truth. And it's going to come out in a way that nobody is going to be willing to listen. And you're going to be quickly labeled a problem. And if this has happened to you before, I say, fuck them. And I would rather you speak your truth and it comes out the way it comes out. In the beginning, it's going to be a little, you know, wanky. It's not going to come out in a way that people are going to be like, oh, okay, yeah, I understand exactly what you're communicating in this moment. But it takes a few times before you really find that power within. That first no that is non-conflictive is very powerful because you are reassuring yourself of your power without having to be aggressive or in anger. So you no longer have to associate being your true self and creating boundaries to protect yourself with conflict, which is something that I have found that I'm still working on, but I have found. And obviously there are times that people are going to do whatever they want to do and you're not going to catch it in time. But over time, that is a muscle you must strengthen. And standing straight with your shoulders back will remind you of your own power and the possibilities that you are capable of exploring if you just believe in yourself. So it's not only about good posture, it's about what it means, what that really entails. What is your good posture telling the world? Does that make sense? Okay. 12 rules for life. An antidote to chaos. So again, it's far more complex than just what it says, but I do think that it's a good beginning for this. I think that there's a lot to talk about. If you guys are interested and you are reading the book, let me know what you think. Obviously, I am taking things that ring true to me. There's far more things that he talks about, stories. He kind of sets it up in the beginning with the lobster and the birds and all that. But I'll let you read that and, you know, gather more information. But rule number one, stand up straight with your shoulders back And with that, I say till next time. Bye.